A book explores the cost of free land and what land means at its core. From SDPB, today is Friday, May 9th. This is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, Rebecca Claren grew up hearing stories of her pioneer relatives on the Great Plains. She heard about ice baths in the creek and rattlesnakes on the way to the outhouse, but she never heard any stories about their Lakota neighbors. Her investigative memoir, The Cost of Free Land, Jews, Lakota, and an American Inheritance, explores those stories. And it asks a core journalistic question: who knew what and when? Claren's book is the 2025 One Book South Dakota. Her first stop on her author tour was in our Black Hills studio. We bring you that live conversation today. We're broadcasting from SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Ellen Kester, in for Lori Walsh. You're in the moment. News is first. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Ellen Kester, in for Lori Walsh. Today, we're bringing you Lori's conversation with Rebecca Claren. Claren is the author of The Cost of Free Land, Jews, Lakota, and an American Inheritance. Her book was selected as the One Book South Dakota by the South Dakota Humanities Council. She kicked off her book tour in our Rapid City studio last weekend. Today's show was recorded in front of a live studio audience. I'll let Lori Walsh properly introduce her guest for today's show. Award-winning journalist Rebecca Claren has been writing about the American West for more than 25 years. Her journalism, for which she has won the Hillman Prize, an Alicia Patterson Foundation Fellowship, and 10 grants from the Fund for Investigative Journalism, has appeared in such publications as Mother Jones, High Country News, The Nation, and Indian Country Today. Her debut novel, Kickdown, was shortlisted for the Penn Bellwether Prize, next on my list, by the way. She also writes poetry, with poems appearing in such places as the North American Review, Catamaran, Cutbank, and Poetry Northwest. Now, her latest work, The Cost of Free Land, Jews, Lakota, and an American Inheritance, was named a best book of 2023 by Kirkus Books, The Forward, The Christian Science Monitor, and the Tribal College Journal. It won the 2021 Whiting Nonfiction Grant and a Will Rogers Medallion Prize. It was shortlisted for the High Plains Book Award and the Great Plains Book Award, and was a finalist for Stanford's Saroyan Prize. Saroyan?
Saroyan.
Saroyan? Saroyan Prize. In addition to being chosen as the One Book South Dakota this year, it was the One Book North Dakota last year, and we are very pleased to have her here in the Black Hills of South Dakota, so close to the geography of this book and her story. So welcome. Thanks for being here.
It is truly an honor. Thank you all for being here tonight. This is the first night on an 8-stop tour that will take me across the state, so thank you so much for joining us and for getting to talk to you, Lori.
First of all, I am in love with this book, and I feel like every year there's things that I didn't know about the place that I live and have reported in, on the radio for 10 years, in print for 10 years before that, and I learned so much about everything from you. So this is a life-changing book.
Oh,
let's just start there. So thank you for
the work that you, thank you.
The work that you put into it. And as a journalist, I'm agog with your research and your investigative ability and the things that you do and how you presented it, your voice, narrative nonfiction, all of that. You start this project by asking about the stories that we tell and the stories that we don't tell and why. Mm. And you have this wonderful family who has museums worth of archives, photos, letters, deeds, mortgages. So take us back to the genesis of this story and tell me a little bit how some of those questions about the stories that you tell as a family took root in you and you wanted to explore more.
Great question. So I, as you mentioned, have been a journalist of this region of the American West for a very long time, my entire adult life. And it took kind of an embarrassingly long time before I realized, oh wait, I've been reporting on Native nations and federal policy and how it plays out in small communities and not at all connecting the dots between my personal family story and the things I was writing about. And it made me think exactly what you said. What are the stories we tell? And what are the stories we don't tell? And why don't we tell certain stories? And I grew up hearing amazing stories about my Jewish homesteading ancestors on the South Dakota prairie. And we have what I like to think of as like our greatest hits. Like there's the one about my Uncle Louie who could stand on the back of a horse. And one about my cousin, I never really believe this story, but it's the story we tell, who every morning when he was 5 years old would clear a path between the claim shack and the outhouse of rattlesnakes. And then there's the one that the women in my family especially love to tell, which is about my great-great-grandmother, Fagetka, who in the winter in South Dakota, you all know what that means, she would send her daughters outside and she would arm them with a stick or an axe and she would tell them to crack the ice of the creek that ran behind the house. And then she would strip naked and dunk herself in that water. And this was what we call a mikveh, which is a ritual bath that traditionally Jewish women take to mark the end of their menstrual cycles. So there's this incredible trove of stories. We like to tell the story the exact same way in my family over and over again. But we never had any stories about my family's Lakota neighbors. And the nearest reservation, my family ultimately would own an almost 6,000 acre cattle ranch and at the kind of on the edge of Pennington and Haakon County. And the Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe Reservation was only 13 miles away, which as you all know is a distance at that time, early 1900s, was really easily collapsed and often was when your closest neighbor was like at least 2 miles away. But we never talked about our Lakota neighbors, and I wondered why, and I started to ask.
And I think you would probably agree with this, but I would argue, and I'm curious if you agree, that you couldn't, if you had come here and said, I would like to do this, I'm going to write a book, and who had just shown up, you might have had a hard time making the connections. It's the decades of work and the stories that you had already told. You had come to a place and you had a body of work.
I think it's both the many conversations with Indigenous elders I had had that had really helped me to understand a little bit more my place in American history as the descendant of homesteaders. And you're right, exactly right. I had been hired by an investigative nonprofit organization, investigative journalism nonprofit organization, to write a series of stories about Native nations. And it was really, how does federal policy these days playing out in Native communities and for Native families? And that series ran in Indian Country Today and The Nation magazine. And so it meant that when I came to do this project, and it was through that work that I realized I wanted to write this book, I had people who believed in me, who were Indigenous, who thought this was an important project and who helped make connections. So there's a family that I write about a lot in this book, the White Bull family, who most of them are from the Standing Rock Reservation, also Cheyenne River. And when I first was wanting to meet someone from that family, a source who has become a friend said, oh yeah, I used to be married to that family, and he made a phone call and connected me. And that was really huge because I was coming in the door as a friend or as someone I wasn't coming in the door as a friend, but I was coming in the door through a trusted person.
Yeah.
So that made a huge difference.
This is kind of jumping to one of my revelations I made like near the end of the book, but when we're talking so much, and we'll fill you in if you haven't read the book here in just a little bit, but about this idea of repair. And if you have done harm or you've benefited from harm that has been done, what are we to do with this? And when you said that we didn't know our Lakota neighbors, and at the end there's this moment where you're, you know, kind of hanging out with Doug in the truck and making sure he doesn't fall over. You're a little worried about him because he's getting older and feeling sheepish that you're worried about him because, you know, he can school you and all these things. Then I think, that's part of repair, is knowing your neighbors. And that changed my thoughts about my own job here, living in South Dakota too, where I was like, this is part of what we're doing. We're getting to know each other on the radio all the time, in public, but we're in the truck, we're getting to know people. that's part of the repair that maybe you don't talk about so overtly in the book, but I saw a thread. Did you see that thread too?
I love that so much. I've honestly never thought about it until this moment, but it's really emotional, actually.
I think that's so true. We're also not supposed to be friends with our sources.
Right.
But we are always in relationship with our sources. And that, to me, is the biggest sense of repair that you have done, because here you are in the truck when none of your ancestors were doing that. And they were, fear is very much part of the narrative here.
That's so powerful. And I've been thinking about it so much because of what's happening in the world right now. How do we lean into community? How do we make connections across communities that with people who aren't in our in-groups, and in that way become more resilient as a broader community because of those connections? So I agree, it is through one conversation at a time.
The system is designed to keep us separate.
It's a structural problem for sure.
So let's talk about your family and how they got here.
Okay.
Because they have quite an origin story, which is fairly common for Jewish people to be fleeing. And so many of the stories of your family's existence are stories of exile, historically, mythologically, emotionally,
right.
In rituals. This is about exile and landlessness.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about your family and how they came.
So my family, like many American Jewish people, were Ashkenazi. We came from what was Russia at the time. Today it's Belarus, near what's near Minsk. And my family lived in a little shtetl where they, as Jews, were not allowed to own land. Jews were not allowed to own guns or weapons of any kind. You were prohibited from many kinds of industry. My great-great-grandfather was a smith. We're very proud that he was trained as a smith. But he was excluded from the gold and silver guilds as a Jew, so he could only work with tin. It was deemed a less fancy enough metal for a Jew to work with. And there were other threats. That same great-great-grandfather was in a horrible pogrom, this form of vigilante justice that they were unfairly blaming Jews for some political issues, and he was beaten to within an inch of his life, and he was caught in the fire. The house he had lived in was set fire to, and we think probably his father and uncle died. We don't know anything about what happened to them. And, you know, Russian soldiers would routinely come through towns, and they didn't have barracks, and they would stay with families. And my Aunt Etta, who was our family matriarch, and is a huge piece of this book because she really was the keeper of our family history, in the 70s or 80s, she interviewed cousins of ours who had grown up in these shtetls, and they said, the women, we were always afraid. We were always afraid that the soldiers would rape us when they came through town. So when America opens its borders to immigrants, because at the time that was something America was interested in, my family joins literally millions of other Jews and people from Eastern Europe that come to America. Now, unlike many Jewish families that come to America, come through Ellis Island, and they stay on the East Coast, our first relative who came, he hated New York. And as soon as he had made enough money for a train ticket, he took the train as far as it would go, which at the time was Sioux City, Iowa. There were so many Jews from this little shtetl called Kapulia already living in Sioux City. There was a synagogue called the Ansha Kapulia Shul. And when my great-great-grandfather come, they get into the peddling business. They had sort of a backpack of dry goods, and they would walk between farms. And his route was into the Dakotas. And at some point, he saw a broadside. He heard the news in some way, maybe on public radio, that there was free land on offer in the South Dakota Prairie, in western South Dakota. And he writes to Feg Etka. There's a story. I haven't seen the letter, but there's a story in my family that he writes to her. She's back in Russia with half of the children. The other half have come. And he says, there's free land. Should we do it? You know, no one has owned land in my family for generations because Jews aren't allowed to own land. They don't have any idea what it means to be farmers. But she says, oh, you have bad health issues. you should do it. And we think they thought it was going to be like a Dacha, like these fancy country homes that Russian like royalty had. And, you know, short story long, he ends up on the South Dakota prairie in a cave, living in the glamorous life.
You would think then that if they are fleeing and they come to this land, that they would be in tune with or aware of that the land belonged to someone else. But so you are determined to ask yourself this question again and again: what did they know and when? Who knew what and when did they know it? Which is a very journalistic question to ask. Who knew what and when did they know it? Tie that with another powerful journalistic question, which is follow the money. And in this book, land is money. Follow the land. And I want to dive into that in the sense that you don't own this land. This is fairly removed from you. And yet you are determined to ask those questions and find out, how did this land make a difference for these people to launch them into what many of us would call an American dream?
So I didn't, you know, books are built on other books. I'm very lucky that there was so much wonderful scholarship and writing about this region that had been done. And books, as you know, are built on thousands of conversations, and I didn't have to do this alone. And there's an indigenous judge named Judge Abby Abinanti who lives in Northern California. I'm gonna circle, we're gonna get back there. It'll take a minute. And she early on said to me, when I was just thinking about this book, I hadn't even started to write it, she said, you know, if you're gonna go tell this history, what I think of as like an entangled history of my family and our Lakota neighbors, she said, you really have to think about how to respond to it. You know, and we know justice works best when done in a cultural context. She said, you should study the Jews. What do the Jews say about how to respond to a harm, even one you definitely didn't directly commit, but one you've benefited from? And that led me to spending several years studying ancient Jewish texts with my rabbi in Portland, Oregon, for ideas about how do we do atonement, how do we do repair. But what were we grappling with? What were we repairing for? And it's exactly that, those journalistic instincts, that here I was sitting on this trove of family story and I wanted something resembling a fact. And so that thinking, like, land is money, what did the land mean? I know that because of the history that exists, that the United States broke many treaties. They broke an initial treaty with the Lakota in 1851, and then they kept breaking those agreements. You all are nodding, you know this history. And that's what made the homestead available to my family, that land was even available, that was on offer. But to try and figure out, well, what was the true benefit to my family that truly came at great cost to their Lakota neighbors, I dug into the deeds and the mortgages. And there is someone here tonight, I won't embarrass her by calling her out, but it was in the middle of the pandemic when I was doing much of this research. I couldn't fly to Rapid City to go to the deeds office, to the Register of Deeds, and sit there and hole up and go through these big, massive books. And so this wonderful woman who is a historian helped me. I paid her. She dug into the deeds. We had all of the information of the land records, and she would copy them, and I made Excel spreadsheets, and I did a lot of math, and I had people check my math. And what I found was, over and over again, my family would take out a mortgage on their land. The Jews were not the only people doing this. This is everyone on the prairie. You know, when you pull out the big mortgage books, you see everyone around them is doing this. This is the basic building blocks of American capitalism. We use land for money. And they would take out these relatively small amounts of money, but when I compared the dates to all these letters and journals I had, I could see this connection. They would start a business that wasn't reliant on weather. My family gets into the saloon business in the Black Hills. Or they would buy more land, or they would even move, but they would keep the land. The land was like an ATM machine for them. And add it all up, in today's dollars, those relatively small amounts of money taken out from between 1905 and 1970, when my grandmother and her sisters sold the last bit of Jew flats, $1.1 million. $1.1 million.
You say everybody's doing this, everybody except...
The Lakota certainly weren't doing this.
Yes.
They weren't allowed to do that. If you had land on the reservation, the law would not allow you to take land out in that way, money out.
The system is set up so that they cannot do this, so they are separated. So we're talking everything from removal to termination to allotment to the Homestead Act. All of this history is outlined here, and you point to other scholars who have done this work as well. And the notes section in the back is just brilliant and wonderful. But even to this point where you're saying you could have someone here helping you find the records that you need, Doug Whitebull tries to find records from his family, and he can't get them. Why not? What's the holdup there?
Well, I don't know. But bureaucracy is certainly has something to do with it. But, you know, Doug couldn't waltz into a county deeds office and say, here's the legal agreement, like legal description of my family's land. Please let me have these records. We had to go to the Bureau of Indian Affairs, and I don't really know what happened. We made phone calls and letters and emails, and we never could get that information. And maybe we did something wrong, but we did not get the information. It was really difficult. It was far more difficult than it was for me, not even someone who lives in this state currently, to get those records.
When the judge says, you know, go to your own traditions and look for, because every culture has a way to repair harm. I mean, I'm like, oh, please don't say that to me, please. Please. It's like, oh, how inconvenient. I have to do this work of understanding where I came from. Because as afraid and fearful as some of our early ancestors were that they would lose their culture, I find that younger people are kind of happy to have let some of that stuff go. Mm-hmm. And it's inconvenient to look back at some of it. Did you enjoy that process of looking back at it and working with your rabbi? Or was there a moment where you were like, oh man, I had to do some spiritual work now?
I think that often I'm attracted to stories that force me to do the work I wouldn't do, but because it's work, you know, it's for my job, I'll learn something that I know I actually really need to learn for my personal life. So I was grateful that I had help, that the rabbi, because I wouldn't have known. I have Shabbat with my family every Friday night. I had a bat mitzvah. I belong to a synagogue. I had never studied the Torah and the Talmud. I didn't know how to do that. And Hevruta is this traditional form of study in pairs. That's all it really means. And it was really wonderful to study these things, to debate the ideas, to grapple with what they mean. And we were often also looking at modern day rabbis who were reading these ancient stories and helping us connect them to the issues in our lives today, particularly native land dispossession. So that was, I actually loved it. I loved the whole thing. It was hard. And it also, there were things I learned about Jewish history, ancient Jewish legends and stories that I found upsetting and uncomfortable. So, and there was a unique parallel in that in terms of seeing my own family in more clear lens. Every time I would get these letters translated, many of them had been written in Yiddish or just find old things. I tried to send them out to people in my family to see. And one of my cousins said, after kind of a whiny letter from our great-grandfather, it said, this is so humanizing. You know, you've got to feel more compassionate, not only to our ancestors, but to ourselves, I think, to start to see we're not more messed up than they were. We just have always talked about them as being so perfect and religious and so nice to each other as siblings.
Because of the stories.
Yeah.
Because the stories that we tell again and again and we want to pass down. The question of who knew what and when is slippery, and it's far more nuanced, and that is one of the things that in some ways you have to throw up your hands and say, I'm never going to know everything I would like to know. Tell me about some of the signposts that you saw that said, yeah, they would have been aware of this, and then the empathy that you found for some things that they might not have quite understood the systems they were operating under.
Well, Judge Abby said to me at one point, she said, everyone knew what was happening to Indians. Because I really had this question, here my family, what does it mean to have survived oppression only to come here and become part of an oppressive system? were they making that connection, and were they, did they care about it? I could find nothing in the literal thousands of pages of letters and journal entries. There was nothing about Native Americans. They lived in the Black Hills. They called the Black Hills God's country. They loved it. They never were thinking or talking about the ongoing court case by the Sioux Nation to get the Black Hills back. So I didn't know, but Judge Abbey said to me, everyone knew what was happening to Indians. And frankly, the journalistic record shows this was being reported in the paper. It was in the newspaper that people on Rosebud and people on Cheyenne River did not want the reservation opened to white settlement. It was happening anyway. And then Judge Abbey said in the next breath, though, she said to me, but when you're running for your life in terror, which is what your family was doing when they came to this country, you're not stopping to have a quick restorative justice conversation. She said, you know, it's gonna take several generations of not living with that inherited trauma of being in exile, fear of exile, to step into this history. She said, that's why it's right that you and your cousins and your brother, that you're coming into this history and looking at it and finding yourselves here now. So does that answer your question?
And it brings me to this idea that I really want to dive into a little bit, and that's that they bring this trauma with them. The journey is traumatic. What they've been through in Russia is traumatic. Then they get here, and caves and sod houses and the very rattlesnakes between the outhouse and sickness and, you know, freezing cold baths and anti-Semitism. And yet they're also, so what are some of the ways that you found that maybe weren't the most popular Saturday night stories, but that you could see the evidence of that baggage that came across the nation with your family?
They were so afraid of being pushed into exile. So on the one hand, no one ever wants to describe themselves, or I don't know, in my family, no one wants to talk about being a victim. But my aunt Etta, my great aunt, would say, oh, we never experienced anti-Semitism. And then in the next breath, she would say, but when we were out in public and we were talking about something Jewish, we always whispered about it. And you know, at first I never had heard any stories about my family and their Lakota neighbors, but after I interviewed every single person of my mom's generation and older who might have handed down stories, and eventually I did hear one. My cousin told me a story of her mother who was, or her grandmother rather, that where our family's homestead was had been part of an ancient trail between areas of Cheyenne, what are now today Cheyenne River, and areas of what are now Pine Ridge. And that during the collecting season, when many Native children were collected and taken to boarding schools far from their families, there would be times of the year where people would come through that trail to go visit their children and try and see them. And there are stories of my Aunt Rose when she would see Native people walking across the prairie, and this was probably in like the 19-teens, she would quickly kill a chicken, and she would harvest things from her garden, and she would set them out. She was not doing this out of the goodness of her heart. She wasn't trying to build bridges. She was afraid. And she was doing this to sort of say, here, have this, and then leave me alone. And I got really curious about what were the racist messaging that my family is hearing when they first come to America. They spend a couple years in Sioux City before coming to the plains, out here to South Dakota. And so I did a deep dive looking at how did newspapers talk about Native Americans? How, you know, what were the kind of things that were happening there? And you know, they learned very quickly that in America, whiteness is graded on a curve. And as Jews, they looked pretty white. But as people who were not, their status was a little wobbly, they did what so many people do. And they kept that fear, did not give them an open hand to people who had less status than they did.
We've just done some reporting on Giants in the Earth. Book of Norwegian Settlement by Ole Rolvag. And one of the things the scholars were telling me was how he, as a scholar, believed in pluralism, and he admired the Jewish people because he felt they were the example of how America should be, that everyone should have their own culture and they should keep their language and they could do all this. But then I was reading your book and I thought, well, isn't that an interesting, you know, all this history is stitched together, that your family was very specifically yes, but also secretly and quietly those rituals. And perhaps Rolvag saw this and thought it was inspirational. However, pluralism and the balance of being yourself, not losing your identity, not losing your language, and yet surviving in a culture where you're not the dominant culture. There's a lot to unpack there.
When I it wasn't until working on research for this book that I started to connect certain dots and to see the deep, on the one hand, I would say my family continues to be very proud to be Jewish. The coming of age ceremony of having a B'nai Mitzvah when you're 13, I don't know anyone in my family who hasn't had that. My son had his recently. It was really top five life moment for me. But at the same time, there is so much pressure on the women in my family. You know, radio listeners, I have very dark brown hair, but there are so many people in my family, especially in my grandmother's generation, who would dye their hair blonde, who were always trying to lose weight, who were really trying to look white. They really wanted to blend. There's a story that my great-great-grandmother told her sons, you have to be millionaires in this country. That was how they would be, and I didn't really understand that until I read and understood more about Jewish history in Europe and learned that over and over again, Jews would be kicked out of whatever country they lived in, but often the rich Jews were allowed to stay a little longer. And so there's where this pressure to become a millionaire, they didn't become millionaires, but you know, this pressure to become a millionaire, or maybe they did and then they lost it all.
The pressure to pass, and the pressure to be economically useful.
And then to look like someone a millionaire would marry.
Yeah.
If you're a woman.
No pressure whatsoever.
No pressure. You know,
meanwhile, you lay out this really compelling history of what Nazi Germany learned from American Indian policy.
Oh, God.
And we return, and I told someone, I said, you know, this is we're at this page and we're talking about Hitler and how he was inspired, and now we're at this page, and someone said, why? And I was like, you know, do I have to say why? Because this is a book from a Jewish perspective, and so you never forget that he learned these lessons. Tell us a little bit about that, because I think for some people that's a fairly common understanding of, you know, pre-World War II, and for other people it's going to be brand new news.
So I was a kid who was so obsessed with the Holocaust. I read, was like a teenager, I thought I read every book I could get my hands on. I would stand on the mantle in the living room and like produce the Anne Frank speeches. I really do believe that people are quite good at heart. But I never knew until Doug Weipel, who's a Lakota elder from Standing Rock, told me that Hitler was inspired by how to treat the Jews, by how America treated blacks and Native Americans. I never knew that. And after he told me, I went and, you know, of course, there's tons of scholarship on this. Now, this is not news to anyone in Lakota country. When I was there, I would often hear this, but I can't tell you, I've done 75-ish events in this country since the book came out, and many people are as shocked to learn that as I was. Hitler sent his attorneys to study American law to understand how the U.S. had figured out how to give black Americans and Indian Americans, as they were called then, lesser status, legally lesser status, so he could figure out how to do that to Jewish people in Germany. He said that the reservation system was his inspiration for concentration camps, and the way that he would starve people in concentration camps so that they would have less will to fight back, that was also cribbed from Indian affairs policy in this country.
Likewise, there are things we can learn from modern-day Germany and how they have dealt with their own history. as it's reflect back to us. So let's talk a little bit about that. And in your work of this whole book is an example, a very sophisticated example of making amends using your talent and platform and resources and what have you. Most people aren't necessarily going to write their own books. But you lay out a really smart roadmap, including resources at the back and on your website, where people can start doing their own work of making amends. So from the Jewish tradition, what are some of the steps to making amends, and how did you dive into each one of those steps and figure out, well, how does that apply to this story? How does that apply to me?
Right. So there's layered throughout the book are some of the most meaty, helpful to me teachings from Jewish tradition of how do we do repair? How do we atone? How do we try to make healing? And there is this famous ancient Jewish philosopher, we call him Maimonides, and he scripted these steps of repentance. They're a little annoying to me because they're so legalistic. Like literally the last step is to return. You'll know you have had success because you will be in the exact same position on the same Sunday afternoon and the same thing will happen and you'll make a different choice. But, I mean, not exactly a Sunday afternoon, but you get what I'm saying. But the first step is to stop doing the harm. And I would argue that in this country, we are continuing to harm many Native Americans. And the next step is to say the truth out loud. And so in many ways, this book is my effort to take that step. But interestingly, in these steps of repentance, you don't apologize until a much later step. And before you apologize, you have to change yourself to be the kind of person who wouldn't make that same mistake, and you also try and make it right for the person who has been harmed. And so that led me to have a lot of conversations with Doug Whipple and other Lakota elders about what could my family do? And so that was part of the thinking behind what we ended up thinking about how
Nick
to respond.
Nick Estes, who wrote Our History is the Future, I'm going to paraphrase him now, but we were talking about a similar thing, and he said, if you've stolen somebody's car, don't go driving by and say, hey, this is a great car. Like, you might have to give back the car at some point. So from his perspective, stopping doing the harm is top of the list. How do you stop doing? And you might not have control of the car, okay, but there are ways that you can look at how your family has done this work. I love the idea. It just blows my mind. Become the kind of person who will not make that mistake again.
And I think that, how do you do that? Well, yeah. It's funny because traditionally Jewish people might just change their name. Oh, I'm not that guy anymore, I have a new name. But now it's therapy. Now I would argue it's conversations, like the ones you're often having. I do feel like it's through conversations with people that I have come to have any insight or change, right?
You have forever changed the stories of your family that will be passed down to your children.
Yeah, I hope so. That's why I thought for a long time I would dedicate this book to my elders. And there was a moment where I realized, but it's not for them. It's for my kids. So it's dedicated to them.
What were your conversations? How old are your kids?
They're 10 and 13 now.
Okay. So old enough for you to be having some. They understand what you do for a living. And you were able to have some conversations with them.
Tons. And in fact, during the pandemic, when again, it was, we have high-risk people in my family, so I wasn't going to fly. It was the middle of summer. There were no camps. There was nothing. And also, it was incredibly cheap to rent a minivan. We were able to rent a minivan for $10 a day. And my husband and my 5-year-old and 8-year-old at the time, we packed up and we went on a family road trip and we drove from Oregon to South Dakota so that I could do research in the Black Hills. So they became a part of the reporting trip, actually. And we visited Deadwood and went to the cemetery. And it was really fantastic.
Yeah. In fact, you're in Deadwood and you're watching a shootout with your kids in the book, and then you're talking about, you know, liquor and the ways that, because your family moves into this booze business, essentially.
Totally.
And that becomes a sticking point in the book where you get to this point where there is some bootlegging going on. And Not everyone in your family wants to tell the story.
There's a Jewish word or a Yiddish word called a shanda, which means a great shame. And for people of my generation, the fact that our ancestors were bootleggers, we're pretty proud of it. But the people of my grandmother's generation were incredibly ashamed. They were very embarrassed. Ultimately, I write about this in chapter 8, my uncles spent time in Leavenworth. He not only was a bootlegger, he got caught. And I had some relatives who really didn't want me to write about that. And I decided, you write what you have. And so I put that in the book, those conversations of, why are you telling this family secret? You're gonna cause harm. I mean, it was again a conversation about a different kind of harm. You're gonna hurt people in our family by telling this story. And it took a lot of listening and a lot of hanging in there. And I actually really feel like it wasn't true, that all those fears were not realized. And I think I can even say some healing came from us expunging those old secrets, but it was not easy. And I know many people are reading this book. I hope this is true. I love it when readers write to me and say, I've been thinking about my own family history, I love genealogy, and this has helped me think about how to approach writing about my own family secrets and stories.
And I think I told you beforehand, like my family, I don't know if this is a white Protestant thing to say, but we would be so pumped if somebody was, like, we would have t-shirts made. Like, I don't know, we would be looking for the outlaws, which again makes me ask some deep questions about my family and where we come from and what is our relationship with, and then it gets real uncomfortable real fast. How hard was it to report on your own community? On your own family, but then also other people are like, don't feed into that stereotype. Mm-hmm. Don't tell people about the mortgages. Don't tell people anything that feeds into current day anti-Semitism. We want you to play that down.
It was hard. It was really hard, and I didn't see it coming, honestly. And I think because this book was meant to be somewhat of a corrective to say, yes, Jews have been victimized. We still are victimized in many places throughout the world. And we can also be victimizers. I was trying to say that it doesn't give us a pass on our responsibility to ways we have benefited from federal policy and law. And I didn't see coming how tricky it would be for me to write about my own community. And it was, again, I didn't have to do this alone. A dear friend of mine who's a Jewish studies scholar read an early draft, and it was her encouragement who said, I felt a little hurt, like it made me a little hurt for your family. And I had to apply the same lens to write the book I really wanted to write, which was a book deeply committed to the truth, but also a work of great compassion. I had to apply the same empathy that I tried to apply to the Lakota to my own family. Yeah. And that was healing for me. And what was so exciting was the way that I got that compassion was actually to study history. When I studied the history of the Jews and I could contextualize where my family was coming from, why they were doing the things they were doing, it actually made me feel more for them, which was a great feeling that maybe writing a book of history could do that for other people.
Yeah, that was beautiful. Just that what land meant.
The land, I mean, they had a very difficult life, as many of you probably have stories of your ancestors if they tried to farm and ranch in this very dry land before there was irrigation. And they called it the good earth. They loved the land so much. They were so proud that they, for the first time in generations of our family, could be landowners. And it made them, they told their children, owning land in South Dakota made them feel like real Americans. It made them feel free.
This is, I think, one of the most optimistic sentences in the book. It just gave me such great hope, and maybe, again, it's the journalism connection that we have, but you're talking about Doug Whitebull, and you say, every time we speak, he will teach me something, remind me of what I should be asking. And after all this time, his perspective has filtered into mine, changing me. This is the power of a question asked again and again, and then realizing it's the wrong question. Again and again, I was asking the wrong question. I was asking, and I go back to this show, 5 years ago, certainly 9 years ago, and I think, what, that is just the wrong question. And the patience that people had with me to allow me to ask a better question and a better question. Did you do that intentionally? Did you take notes? Did it kind of come to you naturally, where you sort of realized that you were filtering in his perspective, and that that had changed you not only as a journalist and as an author, but as a parent and as a human being?
I didn't know I was doing it at the time, but certainly after a stack of years, it was just so clear. It was very clear. I am so grateful to the whole White Bull family for trusting me with their stories, and Judge Abby Abenanti for helping me really continue to think through so much. I mean, it's filtered into my life. These conversations have changed my life in so many ways. I think, one, it's very small, but it feels big in my small family. My kids, you know, kids can be jerks. They are jerks. And brothers fight all the time. And I think before I had spent time, for example, with Judge Abby, they would just say, "I'm sorry." And I had, after I had spent time listening to her talk about the way she runs her courtroom, I came back, I said, "We have to do this differently." Now they know to say, "How can I make it better? I'm sorry, how can I make it better?" And it starts that kind of conversation. And they're still jerks, but it's nice.
I'm wondering if there's anything that you have working on in the future that you want to talk about. And if not, that's okay. If you're one of those people who doesn't reveal what's next for you. But is there a big project on the horizon? And then I'm hoping we can get you to read a little bit from the book, which I was going to do earlier, but I got so engaged in everything you were saying. So I do want to make some time for you to read from the book. But first, what's next for you?
I think I don't have a book deal yet, but a conversation I have had with my same editor for this book and my agent, what emerged from this long conversation we had recently, is another book that's a blend of a personal narrative with investigative journalism and history. This story, am I jinxing it by talking about it on the radio? I don't think so. My aunt and uncle were murdered on Pan Am Flight 103 over Lockerbie, Scotland in 1988. And I am gonna dig into that history, but as a way to talk about a wider, deeper story about the interconnection between justice and grief. What happens when we have a justice system in America and beyond that doesn't attend to grief? And what happens when we have unrealized grief? How does that set up, you know, cycles of vengeance or not? And I probably will search for models in our history and throughout the world that integrate those things better. So I'm just at the very beginning, but I think that's my next project.
You have not jinxed it. You haven't opened a whole door of thinking about the future. That is incredible.
Rebecca Claren's book, The Cost of Free Land, Jews, Lakota, and an American Inheritance, is the 2025 One Book South Dakota. And that is our show for today. From all of us at SDPB, thank you for listening.